From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, it's the Week in Review. We'll reflect on how to move forward after mass shootings. And then we'll take up Massachusetts' immovable traffic.
By 6 o'clock in the morning, 1 in 4 miles of roadway inside 128 is already congested or highly congested, and the afternoon rush hour essentially begins at 3 in the afternoon.
But first, Suffolk County District Attorney Rachel Rollins on the Boston Police Department's controversial sweeps of the South End.
On the one side, we're talking about the importance of law enforcement and community having great relationships. That's what the mayor, the commissioner, and I were saying. Out of the same side of our mouths, we are sweeping people up.
We'll take your calls on all of it. Next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. We'll turn to our week in review in a few minutes, but we want to start today in the South End, where recent police actions have inflamed tensions between residents, activists, and law enforcement. Last Thursday, a Suffolk County House of Corrections officer was assaulted in the South End. Following that event, the Boston Police conducted Operation Clean Sweep, which resulted in 34 arrests last Thursday and Friday. The operation continued on Tuesday, and though there were no arrests, photos of a garbage truck crushing a wheelchair have sparked questions about what the police action entailed. Even before this incident, the neighborhood was dealing with rising crime rates. According to the Boston Globe, in the first 8 months of 2019, robberies and aggravated assaults are up 41% in the Quarter Mile area around the intersection of Mass Avenue and Melnia Cass Boulevard. Boston Police Commissioner William Gross told reporters yesterday that the witness accounts of wheelchairs being confiscated and destroyed are inaccurate, and police actions are being taken out of context.
There are several abandoned wheelchairs there, and anyone that needs a wheelchair, they're given a wheelchair. Those wheelchairs were covered with feces, blood, and urine, and they were used like a pincushion by discarded needles. They were a hazard. We got them out of the way.
Now, in a few minutes, we'll take your calls at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. But first, we spoke this afternoon with Suffolk County District Attorney Rachel Rollins about Operation Clean Sweep and when she found out about it.
I found out about it after the fact. But I have been in contact, as I normally am, with Commissioner Gross. I don't think it was intentional, but I learned of it with the rest of the public.
You've expressed concerns over how police are handling enforcement in the neighborhood. You recently tweeted that homeless people and people suffering from addiction, quote, are not debris. They cannot be swept away, end quote. Can you tell us more of what you meant by that?
Yeah. I mean, I think we reacted to an attack that many of your listeners have seen a video of. But there are endless groups of people that find themselves in that area, many of whom are not violent, many of whom have a substance use disorder or a mental health issue, or are homeless. And we've sort of conflated everything into let's sweep everyone into one big group, and then miraculously there won't be a problem anymore. And I'm simply saying that I really want us to think about investing resources to get people help instead of just sweeping them down the street into Dudley Square now, right, which is essentially what's happening.
Mayor Walsh told reporters yesterday that there is a public safety issue at play as well, which does create some tension in terms of how you respond. Here's a piece of what he said.
This is an epidemic. Again, I mean, I think people can't, we can't have people shooting up on the streets. We can't have that kind of devastation, people praying. We have prostitution that I'm hearing that's happening out there. Young people being prostituted for drugs. We're having drug dealers coming down. They're preying on these folks. We need to do everything we can to keep them safe.
So there are competing needs here. How do you balance the need to protect residents from crime while also looking out for the best interests of those who are homeless or are suffering from addiction? How does that balance come into play?
Yeah, I mean, I just reject the implication that public safety and public health are mutually exclusive, right? And we've had 18, 19, 20 people arrested the first evening, and then there have been any number of additional sweeps, for lack of a better word. The overwhelming majority of the people are not from Boston, and some of the individuals weren't violent at all, right? As of right now, I have personally attended the arraignments of three individuals, one charged with trying to steal the vehicle, and two that were actually involved in the physical altercation with the corrections officer or sheriff. So for me, those are distinct and different groups of people.
One of your keystone reforms hinges on the idea of not prosecuting low-level crimes. Based on what you just said, is there anyone in the list of 34 people who were arrested that you know you don't intend to prosecute?
Yeah, so I want to make sure we are really important with our words, is that in the first instance, my list, we say we're not going to prosecute. We're going to slow things down and look at each person individually. If there are people on that list, Tatiana, who are just coming into contact with the system for the first time and are charged with possession, yes, I am very comfortable and have spoken with the commissioner and the mayor about the fact that I'm not going to be charging them with a crime. I'm going to be seeing whether or not we can get some services for them. They are distinct and very different from individuals that violently attacked or beat somebody outside of their vehicle, and we're going to hold those individuals accountable for the felonies that they're alleged to have engaged in.
You know, your decline to prosecute policy, it seems like it was intended to discourage exactly this broad type of police action. Is that correct?
Well, here's what I am going to say, is the police are in a position right now where they're the only ones that are receiving the overwhelming number of calls from business owners, from people driving by and witnessing what it is that's happening. And what else are they supposed to do? You know, I mean, I feel like we need to have a lot of other people sitting at the table and involved in coming up with solutions. But we have a lot of work to do. And I just don't think that arresting is going to be the solution. I think we need to have a couple more tools in our tool belt.
D.A. Rollins, Boston Police Commissioner William Gross said that part of the problem is that there aren't adequate facilities to help people who are suffering from addiction. Let's hear a little bit of that.
For every 10 people, there's only one bed. And two-thirds of the people are from outside of Boston. What are we going to do about that? The Boston Police Department isn't the panacea. We're the easy target. When something goes wrong, oh, it's the police fault.
It makes me wonder, based on what you said before, is this another instance where we're relying heavily on the capacity of law enforcement to respond because we don't have the necessary capacity elsewhere to address addiction?
Yeah, but I reject that. We do have the necessary capacity. We just need to start putting resources into getting people treatment and beds.
So you think we have enough beds, we have enough counselors, et cetera?
No, I think we need more resources to go towards beds, right? Like, I open the newspaper and see that we're putting $28 million to refresh Boston Common. You know, obviously that's wonderful and trees and benches are important, but we have human beings that need beds and services. I am not going to vilify Commissioner Gross because he's doing his job, right? Like, they are technically committing crimes when you are possessing and using drugs. I've made it clear that I believe that's a health crisis, and I'm not going to brand them with a record, but we need a lot more people at the table and we need some resources. He's absolutely right. The overwhelming majority of people that are swept up when the police arrest are not from Boston, and we are housing them and we are dealing with all of these issues, right? And I personally, even though Sheriff Tompkins does a wonderful job at the House of Corrections and Nashua Street, South Bay and Nashua Street, I don't believe people should be getting treatment for their substance use disorder or mental health issues inside of a house of corrections. I think they should be at a treatment facility that is exclusively set up for their health issues, not to house them because they've allegedly committed a crime.
So, D.A. Rollins, you just referenced the fact that some of the people arrested and some of the people in question here aren't from Boston. As people learn about its services, come into the city and are in need of services but aren't from Boston, how does the city and the county balance that? And is there a point where the city has to say, we can't do this for everyone.
Yeah, I mean, I find that we need to start talking at a Commonwealth level and involve Governor Baker in this conversation, and the mayors or city managers of different towns and cities across the Commonwealth, right? You see what's happening with Quincy and the Long Island Bridge. They don't want these individuals, quote unquote, right, in their community. But Boston can't be the place where everyone comes, uses our resources. You know, we're sweeping them up in these raids, for lack of a better word, and then I'm dealing with them in the court system, and then their towns and cities don't have to in any way get involved in the communication or the discussion about how we're going to solve this problem, or quite frankly, put some money on the table so that we can help get them the treatment that they need. It has to be a broader conversation. The mayor is absolutely right.
I want to come back to this question of law enforcement again for a minute. You know, this action has been titled a sweep, and I found myself thinking about the ICE raids in Mississippi this week, where almost 700 undocumented immigrants were rounded up. That was also called a sweep. And is there something about this approach in terms of the fear and the disruption it causes in vulnerable communities that makes it actively sort of detrimental to the community, regardless of whether the right people end up in custody, or is it an unfortunate side effect of a necessary action?
No, it's really troubling. I look at it and realize that we had National Night Out on Monday, the 5th and Tuesday the 6th. And I believe, you know, as I was driving in sort of a motorcade with the mayor and the commissioner and myself and others, there was a different type of motorcade happening up and down Mass Ave and Melnia Cass. And people, you know, on the one side, we're talking about the importance of law enforcement and community having great relationships. That's what the mayor, the commissioner, and I were saying. Out of the same side of our mouths, we are sweeping people up, right? And when you hear about what's happening in Mississippi with ICE, I'm really proud of the fact that we, D.A. Ryan from Middlesex County and myself from Suffolk, as well as the Chelsea Collaborative and the Lawyers for Civil Rights, we're challenging some of ICE's behavior. It's really sad. And words, you know, they called it a sweep as well. And although it's not overwhelmingly immigrants in this circumstance, it's a very similar situation, I believe.
You know, there's a danger sort of in the public discourse on this about conflating homelessness, chronic homelessness, and addiction. We know in the mm-hmm. chronic homelessness conversation, you know, if people don't want to go inside, you can't make them go inside. If somebody doesn't want addiction treatment, you can't necessarily force them into addiction treatment. So what do we do as a city for people who are not ready for that next step?
I was fortunate enough to walk with the mayor on the homeless census right after I took office. And you're absolutely right. There are many people that are not interested in going into a shelter, either because they've had a bad experience there or for any other number of reasons. I would add to that, with respect to addiction, mental health issues, which are often underlying many of these pieces. You're right, we cannot force people into recovery. That's why I'm really excited that I'm going to be sitting down with the Boston Users Union, Boston Healthcare for the Homeless. I don't have the answers, Tessiana. Mm-hmm. I don't. I would never try to imply that I did, but I want to make sure we have people that are literally on the ground that are dealing with these issues in the very moment we're discussing them, as experts to talk to me about what the right solution is. I think we owe it to them. And we owe it to Suffolk County to make sure that it's not just a bunch of people in law enforcement dictating down what we think the answer is. We need to make sure the community, the nonprofit world, and then the very individuals that we're, you know, claiming we want to help, right, are sitting at the table with us coming up with solutions.
There is one more question that's been on my mind about this particular situation this week. When you're a public leader, sometimes you are beholden to more than one constituent. And those constituents may have needs that are actually in conflict with each other. You know, aggravated assaults and other forms of crime are up 41% in the Quarter Mile area, according to the Boston Globe, around there. So when mm-hmm. you've got multiple constituents, each one has a need that's a legit need, but their needs are in conflict or tension with each other. So business owners, residents versus people who are experiencing addiction or are living on the streets. How do you, as a public leader, decide whose needs come first?
This is an excellent question, and what I can tell you is that the list of 15 crimes that I said in the first instance we aren't going to be arresting or we aren't going to be asking for incarceration, none of them are violent crimes. None of them, I would argue, are serious crimes. When people are engaged in aggravated assault or are engaged in serious crimes or crimes of violence, they are no longer self-harming. They have turned that into something against the community. Even if, Tatiana, they have substance use disorder issues or mental health issues, when you are engaged in behavior that results in violence, like, for example, the individual that attacked the EMS workers, right, a mm-hmm. few weeks back, we will, even with your mental health issues, we will hold you accountable and you're going to have to be removed from the community. You will be removed if you are engaged in that behavior that turns away from self-harm into a violence or an attack or a serious crime in the community. My constituents need to make sure they hear me say that. And I've shown up and done that in the 7 months that I've been here. But it is hard when you have conflicting interests. But the safety of the community is my number one priority. And if there's violence or serious crime happening, we're always going to look at what keeps the community safe as our number one priority.
That is Suffolk County District Attorney Rachel Rollins. DA Rollins, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Tatiana.
What do you think? What do you make of the police sweep this week on Mass Ave in Boston? Call us. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Stay with us. Our Week in Review is next. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Before the break, we heard from Suffolk County District Attorney Rachel Rollins on the recent police operations in the South End, a sweeping away of folks dealing with substance abuse disorders and homelessness. What do you think about it? What do you make of the sweep? What do you think of these kinds of approaches to homelessness and addiction in our community? Call us. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we have a caller on the line, Lori from Jamaica Plain. Tell us what's on your mind.
Hi. Well, I had a personal experience of dealing with the homeless people in the neighborhood. I'm right at the Roxbury Jamaica Plain line near Eggleston Square, and there's been an increase of homeless people in our neighborhood hanging out on that corner. And yesterday morning, I had the unfortunate surprise of finding out that someone had actually gone to the bathroom in my garden. And, you know, I had to clean that up. And then I started calling. Who do I call? I called 311. They said, there's nothing we can do. Call the police. I called the police. They pretty much said, well, you can talk to the community service director. You know, what can I do? He said, well, you can get motion detector lights. You can get surveillance cameras. You can build a fence. You know, I mean, these are all very expensive solutions.
So, Gloria,
I am going to probably do, but what I would just my point is, what you were just saying is, you know, where are the actual solutions at the end of the road? Like, I can call, but like you just said a minute ago, you know, do you serve the needs of the residents, the businesses, the homeless? What are the actual solutions at the end of those phone calls, you know, to actually help people and actually have solutions down the road?
Lori, that is the perfect question for our Week in Review panel. Lori, I'm sorry to speak over you, but now you've really set us up so well to turn to the panel. So I'm going to do that. Joining us now for our Friday Week in Review is Shira Center. She's the political editor at the Boston Globe. Shira, welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me.
And also with us is Michael Jonas, executive editor of Commonwealth Magazine. Michael, great to see you.
Good to be here.
So Lori's asked a good starting question. Let's start there. You know, what's your response to her? And, you know, what do you think is the right next step in response to somebody like Lori's needs? Let's start with you, Shira.
Well, first of all, I think it's interesting that she mentioned she called the police, because this is what prompted a lot of the action in the South End. You had residents calling the police, and that's what in some cases prompted some of the arrests that have gone on. And that's really sort of in balance in terms of action, right? But you mentioned solutions in particular. There's no one solution to this at all. If there was, we would have already figured it out. No city in America, no part of America has figured out a solution yet to this problem, which is the problem in itself. I think it's especially interesting that we're talking about this at a time that overall the opioid-related deaths in the state of Massachusetts have decreased, but yet we see this major uptick, and I think it's a concentration in areas where a lot of people live. So it's just bubbling to the forefront right now.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Marlene is on the line from Lexington. Marlene, go ahead.
Hi. I'm just wondering why action wasn't taken on behalf of the people who actually are working in the shelters and trying to reach out on behalf of the homeless population that they serve before the corrections officer was hurt. In other words, this is a problem that was predicted by people who work with this population, and the encampment on Atkinson Street has been something that they've been observing, dealing with, and frightened by for a long time.
Marlene, thanks for sharing that perspective. I'm going to add one more. We're going to add Ted from Copley. Ted, go ahead.
Yes, I was a property owner in this neighborhood since 1980, and I can only say that what's happened is that the city and the state together have concentrated a population of homeless and drug-addicted people in this neighborhood for the last 15, 20 years. This is a problem that is caused by city and state government. I don't think they can clean it up, but I can tell you that the residents in this neighborhood, as well as the property owners and the employers and the people who work there, are severely impacted. I've had people fornicating in public in the parking lot. I clean out building lobbies every morning with people sleeping there. You can't run a business with this kind of activity going on. The restaurants are dying because to get inside a restaurant, you have to walk through a crowd of homeless people panhandling.
Ted, thanks.
It's intolerable.
Thanks so much for that. Let's take it from there. I'm going to turn to Michael Jonas, executive editor of Commonwealth Magazine. Michael, this is a complicated issue. What are your reactions to these last two calls we just had?
I mean, I think they're expressing what you're hearing from a lot of the residents. And I think that, D.A. Rollins was also speaking to those issues, but also talking about the concerns for the folks who are affected that are on the streets there. And I think, although she said there isn't or shouldn't be a tension between public health and public safety, I think there really is. And I think that's ultimately what this comes down to. I'm also struck that you sort of layer over that. Also, there are really issues of class. There's a lot of issues of race in this whole situation. And the Globe had a really gripping story today on the front page that focused on the South End, which is, as people know, become a very affluent, gentrifying neighborhood, increasingly white. On the other side of this corridor area, are areas of Roxbury that are being heavily affected by this. I spoke earlier this week with State Representative Liz Miranda, who represents that area, and she really was pained by what's going on and really gave voice to the feelings of compassion that she has for the people affected there, but also this strong sense that the neighborhoods she represents are being burdened and disproportionately burdened by this. And although she was not happy or supportive, really, of the sweeps and the way they were done, she's glad to see some action taken. But frankly, she was, I think, a little disappointed or resentful that it took an assault on a corrections officer to finally get this sort of focused attention
point,
as opposed to the concerns. I mean, there have been kids at the Orchard Garden School have been pricked by needles. They've been crying out for years over this.
Let's take one more call, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Kathleen from Medford, go ahead.
Hi, how are you doing? So I'm calling in regards to just the name of this operation, Operation Clean Sweep, and how I find that to be so dehumanizing to the most vulnerable people in our community as they've put up more and more fences to get rid of the green space that forces people into tighter and tighter areas. And with the speed and precision and callousness in which these people without homes, all of their possessions were swept away, including medical needs, including wheelchairs, and how that was just done without a second thought, leaving all these people even more vulnerable without their necessities.
Kathleen, thanks for adding that perspective to the conversation. Shira, where does empathy, compassion, vulnerability fit into this conversation?
Right. Well, I think it certainly fits into the conversation. And there can never be enough empathy, right, for such a crisis as big as this. But if you talk to a lot of the residents in the South End, too, they're out of patience. I mean, it's very clear that this problem is not getting better. It's getting worse. So whatever we're doing, it's not fixing the problem, or the increase is surpassed whatever efforts we're putting into it. So while there is room for empathy, and I think Boston actually, compared to other cities, has a very strong system for people who advocate on behalf of addicts, you need to make sure everyone is at the table for this kind of conversation.
So, Michael, you know, Commissioner Gross pushed back on the framing of the wheelchair as being sort of callously thrown away. He said, listen, there was human matter on it. There were needles on it. This is about public health and public safety. There was such a flashpoint with that wheelchair. I find myself thinking of it as symbolic of a number of intersections. How did you think about it when that piece of this story came forward?
I mean, the image of it is jarring, and I think the reaction of most people is sort of, I don't know, outrage or a feeling that this is overreach by the police. And that's certainly, when this thing took off on social media, what the sense was. I know that the police pushed back on that. City Hall was originally saying that it was more complicated than that, which is what the commissioner is saying. At the same time, the city's chief of human services was at a meeting in the South End the other night, and he said that was a mistake and that shouldn't have happened. So I think this tension, again, between public health and public safety, frankly, is something that you're seeing reflected even in statements by leading city officials.
So we're going to make a shift now into a conversation, another very challenging one, which is the aftermath of the mass shootings this past weekend in El Paso and Dayton. Listeners, you can call in about that at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Before we leave the South End, though, we had a lot of callers. So I just want to take a couple more, and we're going to give the callers the last words on that subject. Nancy from Route 95 in Maine. Oh, we lost her. So Michael from Dorchester, do we have Michael? No. So this is your...
Yeah, hi there.
There he is. Great. Go ahead, Michael.
So I work as a paramedic in Boston, and the population of people that they swept up, I guess as they're calling it, is exactly the population of people that I work with on a daily basis. This was just a colossal waste of time, because the problem is any paramedic or EMT that you talk to will tell you that they are constantly taking the same people over and over again, taking them and locking them up and not offering them any type of care. All that's going to happen is they're going to serve whatever time that they got, and they're going to end up exactly back where they were in the first place. So they're just refusing to acknowledge the fact that they have to invest in public mental health care. Just throwing them in jail, this is, like I said, they're going to serve their time. They're going to end right back up on the street where I'm going to be picking the same people up on a first-name basis again and again. They have to accept the fact that they have to financially invest and actually treat
Michael, we're losing you, so you're cutting out on the line. But I want to thank you. You know, I think that's that sense of cycle is an important way that we can think about ending that segment. I want to move into this question of how we heal, and are we a nation of survivors after these most recent spate of mass shootings? There were 31 people killed, at least, in Dayton, Ohio, and El Paso, Texas. Here's Boston Police Commissioner William Gross on the question of guns.
You want an answer to how many guns there are? That has to come from D.C. You're going to have to make some tough decisions to ensure that there's unilateral gun laws that dictate background checks, a waiting period, mental health evaluation. Why should there be a rush to sell a gun in the same day? It's too easy to get a gun.
As we've talked to people this week, there seems to be two focal points on healing. Some people want to deal with the guns directly, and some people want to deal with the pain. Let's listen.
I'm lost for words right now. My family's lost for words, but I got to remain strong. People can just go and buy guns and walk right out and kill people in broad daylight, broad nighttime. You know what I'm saying? Like, this has got to stop.
He just turned 63. We had just celebrated his birthday. My mom and my daughter wouldn't be here if it wasn't for him and what he did.
I had to pretend I was dead. He was right next to me. He shot 8 more rounds, and all I could say is, God, please take care of my children. And please, don't let him do anything to my daughter.
1-800-423-8255. Boston, we've had our own pain. What is the path forward in America? Michael, Shira, either of you, what are your thoughts this week? Go ahead, Michael.
Well, I mean, I really worry that we're numb to this. I mean, we hear the voices of people, I think, who've been touched by it or who are close to it. And I think when it hits those communities, it hits hard. I think the rest of us are in some way struggling for how do we react to something that happens 1,000 miles away while we know it could be here tomorrow. But until it is, I think we're sort of in this cycle where, you know, it's Dayton, it's El Paso, it was the festival in California. And it's, I think it's still both a little bit abstract for the people who it's not affecting directly. And frankly, it's just been happened. It's happened so much that we've become a little bit inured to it. So there's a vicious cycle with the occurrence of it, making it harder to marshal kind of public outrage and sort of a call to action, it feels.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Shira, there seems to be at least now some appetite for action, which Michael just referred to. For example, background checks, red flag laws. Here's President Trump this morning speaking to reporters on the White House lawn, standing under that familiar hum we know of the presidential helicopter.
We need intelligent background checks, okay? This isn't a question of NRA, Republican, or Democrat. I will tell you, I spoke to Mitch McConnell yesterday. He's totally on board. He said, I've been waiting for your call. He is totally on board.
Now, remember, the president actually expressed support for background checks after the Parkland shooting as well. But Shira, is something different? Can something like better background checks make it through Congress this time?
Maybe. I mean, hearing Trump's words right there, the key one there was intelligent background checks. So what does that mean? And also, President Trump has said this before and then has not backed it up with legislation. He's talked about some kind of exchange with an immigration policy. I mean, what a lot of people are calling for is they just want this law on the books. They don't want to trade it for a wall or something like that. So I think in terms of D.C., I personally don't think it's necessarily in the cards in the any time in the next few months. But, I mean, maybe there is a tipping point for a lot of these politicians.
What do
you
think, Michael?
I mean, I think it seems like they may take some action. You know, it's very hard to know. I mean, Mitch McConnell has held up bills until now and been opposed to them. So the idea that Trump saying he's very interested, he's ready to go, I think you have to take a wait-and-see attitude, take it with a grain of salt. I mean, there's also another element that I sort of hate to bring up, which is not to be sort of, you know, sort of casting it in such dark terms, but it's not clear that something like the background checks will make an enormous difference in the kinds of things that we've been seeing. It's not clear that that's kind of the key, you know, interdiction point in this whole chain of events that leads to these shootings. It's, you know, we don't know. A lot of these people who have committed these probably would have passed background checks. They didn't necessarily all have red flags, not to sort of throw in the term from another proposed reform, but there weren't necessarily red flags in their backgrounds or anything that would have prevented them from getting approved through a background check. So I think, I mean, it almost makes it even more depressing that it's such a tough climb to get to some measures that, you know, may have, you know, fairly be of limited help.
We're going to have to go to a break. Oh, Shira, go ahead.
Well, I would just add that even if Congress does take action, whatever they do, will it even be enough or even approach enough? Because the situation is so complicated, it's not a matter of just one solution. Let's say they get together and they pass a national red flag law, right? So there are about 6 or 7 or 8 different things you need to do to even get close to some of the gun laws you have in other countries with much lower gun violence rates.
Let's add 1 or 2 caller voices before we go to the break. Thomas from Brighton, go ahead. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, how are you guys today? The guy that was just speaking, he was saying how if you do background checks, maybe the guy would have passed the background check in regards to the red flag law. But that's also not necessarily true. And who's to say that they would go that extra length and wait? And maybe they might not be in the same mindset 2 months down the line or a month down the line however long the background check takes, because it should take longer. And the other girl was completely correct in saying there are 7 or 8 problems. It's everybody's at fault. It's not the Republicans. It's not the Democrats. It's America. America has a, you know, it's Donald Trump was the one who lit the match. Donald Trump can make a difference.
Thomas, I'm going to stop you there just because you've got a very choppy line. But it's both Democrats, it's Republicans, it's America. That's a strong thought. Let's take one last call. Roger from Hingham, go ahead.
Hey, thanks a lot for taking my call, and I appreciate the conversation. It's really important. I have two quick ideas. Number one, the idea that this is an intractable problem is ridiculous. There's effective gun control legislation in Massachusetts that limits the number of, there's an assault weapons ban. There's licensing. It's very difficult to get a personal carry. There's effective, sensible gun legislation in this country that works.
What's the second idea, Roger?
Shootings in Massachusetts. The second idea is this is caused by the Republicans who are in the pocket of the NRA, and you have to be honest about that. And people who say it's both sides is ridiculous. It's the NRA, and it's Republicans who take millions of dollars from the NRA to stop any level of gun control. And so your guests are talking about maybe we can get background checks. Or, oh gosh, maybe we could get...
Hey, Roger, sorry. We have to go to a break. I'm sorry to cut you off, but we're going to have to go to a break. Shira Center, political editor at the Boston Globe. Michael Jonas, executive editor of Commonwealth Magazine. Stay with us. Callers, we're going to continue our week in review with more calls and more discussion on traffic, the MBTA, and the RMV scandal after the break. 800-423-8255. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston's Week in Review. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and it is our Friday Week in Review. Still with us in studio is Shira Center, political editor at the Boston Globe, and Michael Jonas, executive editor of Commonwealth Magazine. And we want to invite you back to the table, too, 1-800-423-8255, for our next topic, which we are calling a transportation roundup. From the ongoing scandal at the RMV, where Attorney General Maura Healey told Channel 2 that the Baker administration bears the responsibility.
This is outrageous. It is just shameful what transpired at the registry. I mean, unacceptable. Lack of leadership, lack of management, lack of accountability that apparently may have led to, may have contributed to serious and devastating harm.
And there's a new study from the Massachusetts Department of Transportation on something we all know pretty well. Traffic is at a tipping point. Here's Transportation Secretary Stephanie Pollack.
The Commonwealth's economy is strong, population has been growing, jobs are being created, and dynamic and flourishing places draw a crowd. That is the first finding in this report. Congestion is bad because the economy is good.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. What do you think is the heart of the story on transportation here in Boston? All right, Michael, Shira, what is the story here? Shira.
Well, I think there are a couple stories here. First, I'll just note that it's always interesting that politicians, when asked about the traffic congestion lately, like the first go-to talking point is, it's because the economy's great. I mean, never mind, wages aren't up that much, right? Okay. All right. Putting that aside for a second, I think the story here is that this is become an albatross around Baker's second term, right? Between what's going on at the RMV, the MBTA, the traffic woes overall, which, you know, is news on today's front page. But if you've been trying to commute into the city of Boston for the last 5 years, is not news to you at all. And these are serious issues, and they extend beyond the core constituencies of the city of Boston. They go into all these parts that politically are very important to Charlie Baker. So I think that is really key for him as he looks forward, because he has indicated some interest in running again, which is another reason why Maura Healey's comments are
so interesting. Right. Well, so, Michael, let me just let you add.
Well, I think, I mean, just to jump on off of one of Shira's points about Baker's constituencies, I mean, one thing that I'm struck by is that in some ways in this whole discussion, the business community has sort of been more out front than the governor in wanting to see big things happen, including a willingness to see taxes, new fees, things that, you know, that they're usually averse to. And the governor has been more in the position of sort of tamping down some of that talk. But I think, you know, to the Secretary of Transportation's point about the economy being sort of, you know, roaring and being the cause of it, I think that the people, the captains of industry in the region, are the ones saying that, that, you know, we need to do something or we're going to imperil that's the very thing that's sort of causing this in her estimation.
1-800-423-8255. Let's take a call. Barbara, you're calling us from Newburyport. What's the story on transportation?
The story on transportation is there are simply too many cars on the road, and trying to manage the cars better is a losing proposition. We need better public transportation. I take a train on a daily basis that's 30 years old. They're infrequent. They're poorly managed. If we had better transportation and better public transportation that actually got people somewhere quickly, there would be fewer cars on the road. And trying to manage cars, you can't build enough highways to accommodate them.
Barbara, thanks so much for that call. Marjorie from Framingham, go ahead. What's on your mind?
All of the congestion and the traffic is all due to poor city planning. And who's in charge of that? They can only blame themselves. They can't blame the regular people just trying to get to work or to school.
Thanks, Marjorie. So Marjorie brings up an interesting point, Shira. We've talked about how clearly transportation is an issue that's kind of hanging around the neck of Charlie Baker in his second term. But this is decades in the making. So one, where else is there blame to be placed? Two, does it matter where the previous blame is? And three, what do we actually do, especially to the point of getting more actual rapid transit in place? You could just answer all those things.
All
for
of those,
us, though.
right. In the next 30 seconds,
that's
no
right.
problem.
Just jump on.
So I think you're right that it is a long-term problem, right? This is something where the investments, and Charlie Baker is very quick to mention this, that the investments were not made prior to his administration. So it is a long-term issue, but I think it's really coming to a head right now because there are so many more people moving into the city. Right. So I think that's part of it. In terms of city planning, you know, this is one of the oldest cities. We have one of the first transportation systems in the country. Exactly. Cowpaths. So I think it's hard to blame that kind of city planning. But in terms, there are other things you can do with city planning in terms of where you build affordable housing or where you build housing in general that can affect these kinds of commute patterns, in terms especially of building outside of the outer ring of Boston and creating transportation systems that are effective and reliable that go there.
So, Michael, this also makes me think of what Rachel Rollins was saying at the beginning of the show, where she talked about this is a Commonwealth level issue. Now, it was on a different subject, but we have become so interdependent in our transportation, and the report really talks about entire swaths of the eastern half of the Commonwealth, at least. So how do we develop integrated strategies around mass transit, congestion, you know, congestion pricing or high-speed lane pricing? How do we develop collective will that's going to get us where we need to go in the time frame we need to do it?
I mean, that's a good question. We'll see if we can do it. I mean, I do think the question about auto traffic and transit are just totally interconnected, and the state of the T questions about the commuter rail service are really closely related to the problems. I mean, you hear of people enduring, you know, hours long commutes in their cars, not because it's so great, but because they think the alternative is perhaps even worse, or even less reliable. So I do think, I mean, there's concern, I think, about the report on congestion that came out that the governor, you know, is sort of inclined to sort of play small ball. He's an incrementalist. He's not one that sort of goes for. He's a big football fan. He doesn't go for He doesn't go for the long bomb that often. And I mean, he did talk in this report about this idea of managed lanes, this idea of creating lanes that would be kind of a premium service lane that you'd pay for. That is an interesting idea. That's maybe the one biggest play in there. But otherwise, he and Stephanie Pollack, I think the best metaphor would be that, like, if our problems with transportation and getting around are sort of the death of a thousand cuts or the result of a lot of different things, their approach is kind of a lot of small steps to try to patch together a solution to it. And there's some logic to it, but I think that there's also, again, some feeling that they need to sort of think bigger on it. I was struck that even the business group A Better City, one of the reaction from Rick Domino, the head of that, was that he wants to hear more about the role of transit in this.
All right, let's take a couple of calls. Dave from Taunton, go ahead.
Hey, you know, imagine if we had gotten the Olympics. We'd be right now in the middle of fixing the T. That's what would have happened. But we decided we didn't want to do it, so nothing's getting fixed.
So, Dave, you couldn't see it, but both the panelists smiled and kind of chuckled. So let me turn to either of them. Dave clearly struck a chord with the two of you. Would the Olympics have made a difference?
I think that's nonsense, frankly. I mean, we've been on an aggressive move with the T. I mean, at least since the great snowpocalypse meltdown of the T, the appointment of a control board, this sort of sudden focus that we need billions of dollars of capital spending to bring it up to snuff. The problem has been, you know, this challenge of figuring out a way to spend the money, the capital money, fast enough. So I'm not really sure what that would have done other than been this kind of sword hanging over our necks of 2024 that might have sort of set the planning and the expenditures off in a direction that wouldn't really necessarily be the ones we need for the long term, but we'd have this kind of short 2 or 3 week event happening just down the, you know, around the corner that everything would be focused on. So I beg to differ.
Okay, let me take one call and then I'm going to come to you, Shira. Alex from Hamilton, go ahead. Alex, you're on the line. Hi.
I'd just like to weigh in on this whole debacle as from the perspective of a student, in that I'm coming from the North Shore where the commuter rail is very impractical. It's infrequent, unreliable, and it's quite pricey for a college student. And then not to mention just trying to drive in at any more practical hour during the day is an absolute mess, and it dissuades me from wanting to work in or around Boston in the future.
Wow, Alex, that is such an important point, and straight to what the Master Department of Transportation report was saying. So, Shira, we're going to do hubbubs in a minute, but let me give you kind of last words on this in reaction to those calls or whatever else is on your mind about it.
Yeah, so what I think is interesting about what we've learned about what went on at the RMV and also at the derailment, derailments, plural, at the on the MBTA lines, is it's taken a lot of the heat off of Keolis and the commuter rail, which until recently was one of the biggest complaints by commuters. And the caller is right. It is expensive. It doesn't run very frequently. At the same time, when Baker released his report yesterday, some of the biggest bottlenecks were on the North Shore, where this guy is coming from. So I think it's important to keep in mind as we focus on these other issues that it's really more than that.
Good. All right. Now, let's end with our hubbubs. We could all use some enjoyable brief stories or events that caught our attention this week but may not have been celebrated in the big time news. Michael, what's your hubbub?
Well, I think I'm gonna try to give us a little moment of uplift here. And so we all know that even day-old bread loses its allure. Bakeries often sell it at half price. So the buzz this week, in bread world at least, was about a loaf that was more than 4,000 years old.
Oh, my God.
And lusciously tasty despite that. The bread itself wasn't that old, but its key ingredient evidently was. So a fellow named Seamus Blackley, who's a video game designer and amateur Egyptologist, got access to an extremely stale but still intact loaf of bread in the collection of antiquities at Boston's Museum of Fine Arts. He was able to draw tiny bits of dormant yeast spores from it, wake up the yeast.
Holy
after
cow.
A week of cultivating the starter, he used it to bake a loaf of bread he describes on Twitter as having a crumb that is light and airy. The one caveat is there's testing underway now to determine whether he actually was able to revive a 4,500-year-old yeast spores or he simply grabbed ambient spores in the air. There's a scientist working with him to determine that. The scientist is betting that these really were from the 4,000-year-old bread. So I think, you know, as humans, we're always fascinated by things that connect us to the past.
Awesome.
I'd say this story takes the cake.
There you go. Shira, go ahead.
I have two questions. First, how does one become an amateur Egyptologist? Number two, did he try the bread?
He did. He said it was luscious.
All right.
And